cockpit.
All right, here we are in the cockpit, as you say. So, yeah, what we're so welcome to Bitcoin Study Sessions. Today we're going to talk about a new book. We finished up Soft War last time by Jason Lowry, which was an excellent first book to begin studying Bitcoin on because of how much it engages you in all sorts of areas beyond Bitcoin, which is kind of what we want to do here, is use Bitcoin as an entry point into a general exploration of just the many aspects of reality that are going to be impacted by Bitcoin and that impact Bitcoin. So today we're continuing that journey. We're going to begin Lynn Alden's Broken Money, Why Our Financial System is Failing Us and How We Can Make It Better. This is a book that Lucas and I have both read before, right when it came out. My particular reading right when it came out was the kind of reading that you do when you just read something quickly, is kind of somnambulistic, like a sleepwalk through it. I didn't get as much as I wanted to, not because of the book, but because I didn't read it correctly. And that's exactly what we want to do in these Bitcoin study sessions, is read a book as it should be read, which is sitting down, studying it, and then putting in our own words and having a conversation about the contents to help push the contents deeper into our mind and engage with them. So I hope that you're doing the same if you're listening to this with Lucas and I, that maybe you have the book, maybe you're reading along, maybe you've read it before and want to, maybe you've also had a sleepwalk reading and you want to have the concepts be more present and alive in your mind. Hopefully this is a forum to do that. So again, encourage you to read along, grab a copy of the book. It's on Audible too, so you can listen to it. Today we're going to break this apart. This Broken Money is broken into 6 parts and 30 chapters. We're going to roughly, I think, try to do 2 chapters each study session. Today we did the introduction and chapter 1, ledgers as the foundation of money, and chapter 2, the evolution of commodities as money. So I'll do a brief summary of the introduction in the first 2 chapters, just so we have the contents present in our mind. And then Lucas and I will discuss the contents and see what of interest we can dredge up and what we can reconstruct from the reading ourselves to help us, again, thoroughly understand what is being said, because this is a phenomenal book. So the introduction kind of begins with, I would say, a quick survey of our broken monetary system. It begins internationally with other countries, Lebanon, Nigeria, Egypt, Turkey, Argentina, Brazil. These are all countries that have been deeply affected by inflation. In Lebanon, that's the anecdote that Alden begins with. She begins strikingly with a person in Lebanon robbing their own bank because they're trying to get their funds out that the bank is not letting them access. And we see, again, all these different countries, they're all racked by the same problem, a broken money system, all this inflation that's causing people to have to renegotiate their wages with their employers because what they have, what they're earning, can no longer buy what it did. It's not just what you might think of as developing countries either. She has a broad survey of countries. She mentions Europe and Japan. Their sovereign bond markets from 2016 to 2021 were 0 or negative yields, which essentially means people were paying for the privilege of lending money to their own government. So this kind of like beginning with these anecdotes, a survey of international examples of a broken money system, and then talking about the United States, we, of course, have inflation, she notes, at a 4-decade high in 2022. We've had money creation at record rates. We have the Federal Reserve, this institution that whose actions affect Americans, but also all these other countries she's mentioned, and whose actions are done by this cabal of individuals who are not democratically accountable. So how does we have all these countries, again, 160 different currencies, many of them double-digit inflation or hyperinflation. But again, the Federal Reserve's decisions about the currency in the United States is affecting all of them because there's a few currencies, she notes in the introduction, that are held kind of as reserves, even by countries who, of course, don't use the dollar for their currency. They're holding stronger money in reserve. But even those reserves, like the U.S. dollar, are inflating away. So Alden notes, quote, "It can be a challenge to save money even in the most stable monetary jurisdictions, as if someone happens, and if someone happens to be born in the wrong quote unquote jurisdiction, it's an incredible uphill battle. So stepping back then, if our monetary system is broken in this way worldwide, how did we arrive at this? So she notes, Alden notes, that history shows three reasons why the global financial orders historically have tended to fall apart: economic imbalances, geopolitical realignments, and new technologies. And this book is going to focus on the last of those, new technology as a reason why global financial orders and the current order we have tends to fall apart. So Alden says, quote, "This is a book about money through the lens of technological developments. It covers the evolution of money in the past, why the current technology and institutions we use for money are failing us in the present, and some of the possible solutions to the monetary problem we now face." So as I mentioned, the book is divided into six parts. And then in the introduction, Alden gives a summary, like a brief one paragraph synopsis, really helicopter view of the whole book. I won't go into each of those parts. We're, of course, going to methodically march through the book here. But she also gives an overall summary in the introduction. She says, quote, this is kind of her thesis in the book that she's going to establish. So I think we're going to revisit this paragraph as we go throughout the book. Quote, "At its core, money is a ledger. Commodity money serves as a ledger governed by nature. Bank money serves as a ledger governed by nation states. Open source money serves as a ledger governed by users. As the book explores, the evolution of technology changes the prevailing power structures and incentives surrounding money from era to era." So again, this is a book about technology's impact on the monetary system. And there we had her thesis that at its core, money is a ledger, and the different ways that getting to open source money, we're going to see how money as a ledger is governed by users. So it's almost criminal to read that paragraph, because that packs in obviously everything the book is going to be about. And we're going to spend the next few weeks, and if you read along, you're also going to see this as the chapters develop, we're going to unpack that paragraph, in which there's a lot of information, a lot of claims. So again, we'll hopefully return to this paragraph. Two more interesting points in the introduction before we move to chapter one. First, she says, Alden says, this is not a banking, a Bitcoin, or a political book. This is an exploration of monetary technology. So part five of the book is, I think, largely about Bitcoin, but I think it's interesting that up front, she says it's not a Bitcoin book. She's not going to pigeonhole herself. And so this is a wider exploration. And two, related to that, Alden notes she is taking a systems engineering approach to analyzing the global financial systems. Systems engineering being a multidisciplinary field focused on design, integration, operation, and maintenance of complex systems over their life cycle. So here we have the complex system, which is the global financial system. And here we have a systems engineer looking at the life cycle of that. And again, talking about how new technology tends to cause a decline of global financial orders. So that's the introduction. Chapter one, then, ledgers as the foundation of money. Money begins as a ledger, Alden notes. And what is a ledger? A ledger is a summary of transactions that is used to keep track of who owns what. It's that simple. It's a list saying that you own this resource, I own that resource. She notes even that like the first written example of this are Sumerian clay tablets that just had a picture of a commodity and like a dot next to it, noting how much of it there was, presumably in the possession of a certain person or entity. But there goes further back than that. There were even ledgers before writing. There were ledgers that are based in, that are conveyed orally and just held in memory. They're not written on a clay tablet. They precede writing. So these were like systems of kind of, you'd imagine they precede, ledgers like this precede what we think of as money and also precede writing. They're systems of memorializing swapped favors. They're systems of credit. Do this for me now, in the future, I owe you a solid. We can kind of imagine an ancient tribe to see how this works. We might keep track of who kills the animals most often, who does a domestic chore, and then doing these things kind of in this informal social ledger we have of exchanging favors and keeping track of them in our minds and conveying them orally, it kind of increases your social standing in the community. We maybe even, Alden notes, kind of evolved the tendency to feel good when we do someone a favor, because that tends toward cooperation and survival of that unit over time. Important, these oral and memory-based ledgers of kind of exchanges of favors or kind of a rough accounting of who is kind of a boon providing a surplus and who is more of a burden to the group. It's an unconscious mental ledger, not necessarily exact. You don't have ticks in your mind for doing favor, getting a favor. All the notes, by doing this favor, I am strengthening the whole group, including myself, and I am banking some personal insurance or social savings for myself and or close kin in the future. I'm expending current worker resources during my time of abundance, and in return, I am collecting some savings in our collective social ledger. So we kind of have talked about this hypothetical ancient tribe, but it actually is beyond ancient tribes. You can think of it nowadays, all the notes, sharing rides with a coworker. I give you a ride today, you give me a ride tomorrow. Giving gifts, we kind of tacitly expect we'll get a gift back. We still have that evolved tendency. We still have informal social ledgers that we use in certain instances to keep track of favors. Notably, though, these oral and memory-based ledgers, these social ledgers, depend on trust and reputation. They're really only effective between family and friends within like a social network that you know the person. When you trade with unknown individuals or one-off exchanges, you can't do them a solid and expect to get a solid back in return. Because again, a one-off exchange with a foreign tribe, you just can't count on that. So the oral or memory-based ledger doesn't work in that instance necessarily. And you have to have some way of doing a spot exchange. If you want to trade spears with another tribe, there needs to be some way of doing an exchange that doesn't rely on simply hoping that a favor gets returned in the future. This is the problem of barter, all the notes that it raises the problem of barter, rather, once you have these spot exchanges, because it requires a double coincidence of wants, which just means that the other person or tribe needs to want something that you have and are willing to give, and you need to want something that they have and are willing to part with. If I have spears and they don't want spears, then, you know, I don't really have something to give them in exchange for something that I want from them. So that's the double coincidence of wants. We kind of each need to want something the other person has and be willing to part with something that they want. So notably, she began all in the day by talking about social credit between friends and family, not strangers. With social credit, that ledger doesn't have that problem of a double coincidence of wants, because I'm doing you a favor now, and then I can kind of depend on you doing that favor in the future. We're all part of the same social network. But now that we have barter exchanges with other tribes, with strangers, we're going to need something to solve this problem of the double coincidence of wants, and that's what forms of money do. An item that is always in demand, so that if I want to get something, if I want to get spears from another tribe, but they don't want any of the goods I have, maybe they would accept the money because it's something that's always desirable. And later on, they would exchange that money for something they do want. So then she talks historically about these early forms of money, shells and beads being a very prime example, to see what it takes to arrive at this thing that might be universally wanted and used as a form of exchange when we don't have goods to barter that the other person wants. Shells and beads, they have the quality of being durable. You can move them through time. Something like food decays, shells and beads don't. They're durable. They're also portable. You can move them through space. You can move, the tribe moves from one space to the next. You can put beads and shells on your person. They're not maybe like spurs or spears. You can't stockpile them as easily as you can shells and beads. They're also universally desirable for maybe their aesthetic value. You can wear them, they're a status symbol. And so you can expect that another tribe might want them. And finally, they're scarce. They're labor intensive to retrieve and or produce. So these serve, this types of early money then serve to replace the oral and memory-based ledger for exchanges with kind of non-trusted third parties outside of your friend and family network. The shells, this is going to go back, as we know, Alden's thesis relates to money being a ledger. Alden notes here in the first chapter, the shells are a ledger. A ledger, again, being a summary of transactions that is used to keep track of who owns what. it's not a physically written down letter, but it rather is a decentralized ledger that's kind of updated by physical possession of passing the literal beads or shells back and forth, updated or maintained by nature because the physical laws of nature are what are preventing more of them from coming into existence. And so we have this, again, the passing around of shells is an unwritten but decentralized form of a ledger. In summary, so to summarize chapter one, ledgers as the foundation of money. Money begins as a ledger, not as coins. Small groups, friends and family, don't need money because we have the social ledger that we can maintain orally through memory, and we can kind of solve the problem of barter before it even arises because we can expect a favor to be repaid later, even if I don't like need something you have now when I'm doing exchange. But the need for money arises when maybe with agriculture leading to larger group sizes, we now are associating with people beyond kin and friend, or we're encountering other strange tribes. We need to finalize one-off spot exchanges on the spot. And so money starts as, quote, nature's ledger. That leads us to chapter two, the evolution of commodities as money. So she notes at the beginning, early money may seem foolish, right? We have these hunter-gatherer tribes. They have high infant mortality rates. They need to be like hunting and gathering, right? So why does it make sense to take time to go out, get shells, punch holes in them, string them up as beads, polish them, do all these things you need to do to make it serve as an aesthetically valuable piece of money when the ancient tribes have all these other, they're living, you know, so close to the thin line between them and death or whatever. But all the notes, good money is a resource because it makes economic interactions more efficient with non-trusted third parties. So there is a benefit to having money. It's not a luxury. Unlike barter, money provides for a common medium of exchange and a store of value. Again, the way previously noted, in which it solves the problem of the double coincidence of wants by providing something that's kind of universally wanted, and then is also portable and durable. So to facilitate this, then we need money to solve this problem, the double coincidence of wants, in order to provide a ledger of interactions between non-trusted third parties. Money should have certain characteristics. Here, Alden draws from the Austrian economic school. She mentions Karl Menger, Ludwig von Mises, and Friedrich Hayek to give characteristics of commodity money. She does note a disagreement with what she calls the credit theory, but she brackets that disagreement on the nature of money until chapter four. So here we again have the characteristics of what she calls commodity money. And those are, one, that it's divisible into sizes that are suitable for different sizes of purchase. Two, that it's portable, it's easy to move across distance. Three, it's durable, it's preservable across time. Four, it's fungible, one unit is as good as the next. Five, it's verifiable, the seller can easily check that the money is real and not counterfeit, something like that. Six, it's scarce in that the supply does not increase too quickly. And seven, it has utility in that it's intrinsically desirable for some reason, could be consumed, used, and or has aesthetic value. These, again, are the characteristics of money, money understood as commodity money. These characteristics tend to make money into the most sellable item. It's always something that you will want to obtain. If you can't obtain something else that you need, like spears or fur, you'll at least want to get money in exchange because it's intrinsically valuable, universally wanted. It also, these characteristics give it the power or virtue of being easily transportable across space and time. Of these seven characteristics, Alden notes that scarcity is often the defining characteristic when deciding between different forms of money. In this, she uses the phrase that we might have heard before, the stock to flow ratio, to define what makes a currency, or one way to talk about a thing being scarce. Stock being how much of a thing currently exists in a region, that's the stock of it. And the flow is simply how much of it is flowing into the region, how much new stock is being introduced. And you want a high stock to flow ratio to be scarce. That is, you don't want too much new flow of the thing coming in relative to how much stock exists, or else it will be inflated and lose its value. The stock to flow ratio is also a good way to talk about scarcity, because a defining characteristic of money, and this is an important concept, is that there is a monetary premium on a thing that begins to be considered or taken or used as money. A thing, when it is used as money, becomes more valuable because people, in addition to whatever other use it has, they also want to hold it to use it as money. That's another use. And they want to hold it for savings to transport value into the future. And so even beyond the intended use of an item, which might be ascribed to some value, there's a monetary premium, more value given to that thing because it's used, it has these monetary characteristics. An example from the present day people might have heard of course, is real estate. We often think has a high monetary premium because people not only buy a house to live in, but nowadays tend to invest in a house as something that they expect to appreciate in value. They want to preserve their wealth over time. And so real estate is used as a savings technology, giving it a monetary premium, a cost or amount of value over the value of the real estate itself. As an example of something that doesn't tend to have a monetary premium, Alden gives, for example, crude oil. It's not necessarily held as savings. Its value is exactly in its intended use. So the deal with things with monetary premiums are people are incentivized to get or make more of it. It tends to increase the flow and so increase the stock, which again diminishes the value of that thing as a currency because it is in, there's more and more of it, and so it's less valuable. Alden gives the example of gold as something that has that is good as that has been historically good as a commodity money because it has a high stock to flow ratio. There's a small amount that is mined each year, which has not really increased, and so even though there's a high monetary premium to gold, people want gold not just because it's useful in electronics or something like that. It does have a high monetary premium, but that monetary premium hasn't been able to incentivize or cause a kind of a flood of flow increase, a dramatic increase in flow. Whereas you can imagine with some things that are easy to produce, if there's a monetary premium, people are going to produce more of them more quickly and increase the flow relative to the stock and decrease its scarcity. So Alden also notes that some theorists just believe that money is just a shared delusion. So hypothetically, I guess you could pick whatever random thing, like a slip of paper. And if we all say it has value, it's or it is money, then it is money. But again, for Alden, because scarcity is important, if a thing picked has a low stock to flow ratio, that thing can be diluted over time and people's savings can be wrecked. So the characteristics of commodity money mean, if we take them seriously, that you can't just designate a random thing and then say that if we all believe it has value or as a currency, it therefore does. No, this is there's some objectivity to what constitutes money under the commodity money theory. This brings us back to the theme of the book, how new technology disrupts the financial system. Alden says, quote, shell money lasted thousands of years in various regions, but eventually became unworkable against the Industrial Revolution. That's because with better tools, shells could be acquired and then polished and made into currency much more quicker. She also notes furs, livestock, salt, tobacco, and other monies also served their useful roles at various times, but the ever-growing technical prowess of civilization eventually made those unworkable as money as well. They worked until technology disallowed them from continuing to work. So again, the theme, technology has ended the use of certain commodities as money because it allowed people that had access to new technology to produce more of the commodity because there's a monetary premium on that. So they're incentivized to produce more of it. That increases the flow and so inflates the stock. Alden then goes through various examples. I kind of mentioned in that previous quote of things like the furs, tobacco, and cocoa beans, of things that began as money, but technological increases because of the monetary premium, people were incentivized to overproduce them once the technology allowed for it. She gives also the famous example, I'll just mention one, of in Bitcoin literature, you might have heard this one, in the island of Yap in the Pacific, Pacific Islanders would, from the specific island, go to another island, Palau, to mine a specific rock. this other island they went to was 250 miles away, but they would go there, extract huge stones, refine them into discs, and take them back to the island of Yap, an incredibly energy-intensive process. And so it tended to give scarcity to these stones once they were on the island of Yap, until a Westerner arrived, and then with better technology could transport more stones quicker and quicker, quarry them and refine them quicker and quicker. And then once that happened, it kind of eventually ruined the monetary system there. I'll just mention the concluding example because it's interesting, and we might talk about this. Massively multiplayer video games. This is also an example of commodity money that Alden gives from Diablo 2. I played this back in the day, so I can verify that this example is true. There was a special item you could get. Diablo 2 is obviously like a dungeon clearing game. You go down there, you try to get magical artifacts and whatnot. One was called the Stone of Jordan, and then it emerged as things that players were using as an implicit form of currency to trade with other players. The Stone of Jordan was an artifact you could get, but it turned out it just had the qualities of a commodity money. Just applying Austrian economics, it was portable, fungible, it had utility, because any class in the game could use it. It was scarce. There was also some sort of divisibility because there were like secondary artifacts that could be used as smaller increments of money or whatever. And so the point of that whole example, I think, is that money is arrived at. Commodity money is arrived at. It emerges as a solution, not by the design of developers, not even by the formal decision of those playing the game. They just converge upon the solution of this in-game item, the Stone of Jordan, having monetary properties within that game. And even outside, I think people paid real-world currency to get Stones of Jordan. But it also, she notes, the same story plays out. Technology is the theme of the book. Technology within the game, it turned out there was a way to hack the game so that you could produce these Stones of Jordan. You could dupe them. And so that just wrecked the Stone of Jordan currency. So to summarize chapter two, commodity money as a ledger requires scarcity, which works until a technology emerges that allows a party to get the upper hand in production. And then it will tend to devalue things like beads, shells, or rhizestones, these stones from the island of Yap, that can then, whoever has this new technology, can increase the flow relative to the stock and inflate and devalue the currency. History then shows that commodities serve as money until technology allows one group to have the upper hand, at which point everybody then must adapt or lose. You can't keep on trading beads once the technology's out there to mass produce them. So that's the summary of the intro in chapters one and two. And so, Lucas, what do you think? Money as a ledger. I mean, I don't want to like put that. This is obviously the hypothesis that's going to get developed over time. But what do you, I thought it was incredibly fascinating to start off with this idea of social credit, even prior to the exchange of any commodity money, any item as money. The doing of favors and expecting a favor in return is like a monetary system.
Yeah, it's a natural emergent property as well. Yes, today as I read this, I was thinking about where in my life do I currently see this sort of flexible social credit? And the first thought I had was double doors. So you and I are walking in through to a building that has double doors. I get to the door first. I hold the door open for you. You go in. What do? You open the door and you hold it for me. If you don't do that, then you have violated this unspoken social obligation that then impacts my ability to trust you. It impacts my desire to interact with you. It impacts basically my trust in you as a person. And so that is so innate to what we have, that coming at it from that direction, from that money is merely a solution to the inconvenience of trying to keep all of these favors in your, it is an external, just the externalization of that, flexible social credit.
but not necessarily just an inconvenience, because it's also the impossibility of expecting the return of a favor from a non-trusted third party, a foreign tribe, a stranger.
That's right. Yeah. Because without that, then you obviate the occurrence of spot interactions, like you mentioned before. It's like, you know, this is the only time that I'm ever going to see this person. I can't take a favor from them, but I still want to do business with them. They still have something that I want, and so we've got this issue with this double coincidence of wants that has to be recognized. I thought one of the things that Alden does is she frames money as a good that is the most saleable good, which is basically just to say that money is the good that everybody wants. And I think it's really important for people when they start, especially when they start getting involved in Bitcoin, to start viewing the world in terms of selling dollars to buy things. Because we don't ever really think, we typically think of dollars, or we typically think of money as the thing we use to buy something, or the thing we get in exchange for selling something. But it's equally the other side of those things, where when you go buy a Coke, what you're doing is you are selling $3 for a Coke. Yeah. And you're buying that Coke. And when you sell a used car, what you're doing is you're buying $5,000 and you're selling the used car.
Yeah. So
I think it's important to think of it that way, because then it kind of takes away this money mystique where if you just treat it like a good, and you place it on top of the heap in terms of this is the most saleable good. This is the good that just, it's not even that everybody wants it. It's that everybody accepts it. Like, in investing, the term is cash and trash. You don't want cash. You want money so that you can buy things with it. But the only reason to have it is to get rid of it in a lot of instances.
Yeah.
And that obviously that exists because we do have this problem with any sort of money that we've ever come up with. Sans Bitcoin has been one that once there's a monetary premium placed upon that, then hard work and technology and voodoo and whatever is going to be used in order to extract that monetary premium. Alden does a really good job, by the way, of noting this, how anytime there is a monetary premium that's placed upon something, technology not only extracts that monetary premium, but it basically destroys that whole that whole system. And thinking about that, so you brought up the real estate example, and I've been thinking about this in terms of real estate too, because, your average starter home in the United States right now is like $420,000, and you can buy a tiny home from China that's like a luxury tiny home for $6,000. You can buy a tiny home off Amazon.
First time I've heard luxury tiny home. I like that phrase, though.
You can buy one off Amazon for like $12,000. And the reason being is that technology has come in and using modular offsite automated design, they've been able to just slap this together, make it very high quality, and then send it to you. And there's another example of like they have these inflatable things that they blow them up, they put rebar over them, and then they spray concrete over them, and then you have a dome. You have a dome concrete house that's done in a day instead of a year or 18 months or so. I find that really fascinating, how technology comes in and just sucks all of the monetary premium out. You know, that's, and the thing is, like, people try really hard. Like, there's still people trying to convert lead into gold. Like, there's still people trying to figure out alchemy. You know, up until Bitcoin came around, it would have been worth it for them to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I have like a fantastical conception of science. So I just hear a word like nanotechnology and I assume that there's some potential alchemical process that can eventually come from the ability to manipulate atoms. And so I'm not, of course, saying that's coming down the pipeline, but conceptually that seems possible. And with a monetary premium over gold, It's incentivized to come up with some sort of process like that. And then, as Alden notes, once the new technology is out of the bag, whoever has it first devalues the money, sucks that the monetary premium out of it, benefits from it, replaces everybody else's goods with an inflated currency that is rapidly losing all value at all. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the other things that I wanted to talk about, kind of bring up, was this concept of scarcity. And in the book and in a lot of writings about money in the past, we talk about how this is scarce and therefore it became money. And I do think that we need to caveat all of those things now by saying that they were relatively scarce and simply happened to be more scarce than whatever the money before was, because now we actually have an absolute, like we have an absolute scarcity with Bitcoin. And so there is a difference. And the difference is that gold is more similar to mosquitoes or bacteria in terms of scarcity than it is to Bitcoin, because the difference between something that cannot be replicated and the thing that you can make 1.5% more of per year,
right. Yeah.
is that's an uncrossable chasm. So like, you know, on the one side, it's only a matter of time until the stock to flow reaches a point at which all holders of that thing have been sufficiently diluted, and those who are close to the source of it have extracted a monetary premium to benefit themselves. There's such a great example in this book of the wampum factory that John Jacob Astor bought.
Right. Yeah. It's like, so describe that. What is...
Okay, so wampum, which people may have heard of, wampum is a proto-money that was made from shells of oysters or clams, I think, in the northeast of the United States. And it was legitimately recognized money. These are fashioned. They're white. There's white and purple ones. The purple ones were more scarce, so they had a higher value. Anyways, so these were used as money in the United States early on. It was something that was adopted from the local tribes. And then when colonists came over, they actually adopted the same type of thing and they traded it. And so there's this guy who builds a mill to make these, like to obviously... Hey, there's money. I can make more of this money. I'm going to do it in an industrial type of process where I'm going to build a mill and I'm going to create more wampum. And this other guy, John Jacob Astor, who I believe like traded furs or something like that. I can't remember what it was, but he came in and he goes, I think I'll buy that. And it's just like, it's so obvious. It's like, oh, there's a money printer and it's for sale. I can buy it for, like, the thing is, whatever price you buy it for, it's worth it. If you can make your own money, like, you can know. So anyways, yeah, I just thought it was really interesting to hear about that. Like, the Cantillon effect, which is, we've talked about earlier with Lowry, was that, you know, the closer that you are to the source of the money, where it is created, the more you benefit, and the further away you are from that source of money, the more you are oppressed effectively.
Yeah.
And so it's just, I think it's awesome to think about how it's not just in this modern era of people suffering from a Federal Reserve and their blatant abuses of fiat money. We can talk about this type of effect of like, hey, there's a money printer. I'm going to go buy it. I'm going to make my own money and I'm going to benefit from being the guy who spends that money first. So that, that just takes me to the problem with decentralized. So money itself is a ledger. We agree. I actually agree like that. I like that idea. It's that money is a ledger, but the thing about like dollars is that nobody has any idea how much money anybody else has. And so that, what that means is that you also can't know when new money is introduced to the supply, which means you also can't change your buying and spending decisions based upon the altered unit of account. So, you know, if the amount of money goes from 5 to 50, but you don't know that, then you're still going to pay for things as though the entirety of the money is 5 units of whatever. And so you're going to be paying 10 times as much. And so anyways, again, a lot of these things that we talk about, like scarcity and, you know, the ability for a ledger to be verified or whatever, they are unique only to Bitcoin. Like Bitcoin absolute scarcity, Bitcoin only ledger that everyone can verify. Everybody knows how much is where it's at. Everybody would know if more was introduced to the supply, because you can just verify using a node. So,
With the ledger that is shells, Alden does note that we are each person who was using shells as commodity money. And so kind of physically changing the ledger by giving shells to another person in exchange for something. They also did not know how many shells were in existence, but there was a way that they kind of rule of thumb were able to verify for a while. They at least knew that shells are difficult to obtain. You had to like dive for them or get them. And there was also some process done to the shells, I think like polishing or putting holes in them and whatnot. So that people at least like, I don't know how many shells are in existence, but people kind of assumed that the stock to flow ratio must be high because the flow, it would seem difficult to dive for the shells and difficult to refine them until, again, things like the wampum factory happen. New technology intervenes that people don't know about. And so their naive conceptions about how stock to flow operates for the currency are disrupted. And they don't know that the disruption happens until all their value has been drained from them in exchange for increasingly worthless shells. There's an interesting aspect of this, and you've been, of course, drawing the analogy to Bitcoin with these early commodity monies and the difference that Bitcoin, the ways that Bitcoin is different as a ledger and as a money. One of the characteristics that Alden gives for money is that that has some utility, and this is what makes it universally desirable, and therefore it's kind of what we settle upon as a shelling point, as something that we will accept in an exchange if they don't have something else we want, if our trading partner doesn't. So commodity money like has these values. And so things like shells, and she mentions feathers, and then of course gold, the value that these has is kind of an abstract form of value in that it's aesthetic. And she also notes they also become status symbols. So it's like almost a circular form of value that they're valuable because we know that they have value. And so if a person is bedecked in beads and feathers, it is like, it signifies abundance. It's a circular form of like abstract value that is the utility of it. Because if I get those, then I can signify that I'm valuable too. And so I thought that was really interesting. I mean, like commodity money, like tobacco, we know that the utility is you can smoke it. But things like shells and gold, feathers, the utility begins to be abstracted in a sense, in that aesthetics is like a human description of value that is not related to consuming it or producing a further thing, in the same way that like indicating status is also I'm referring to it as an abstracted form of value, but it's maybe more accurate to just say it's a value specific to human culture and sociality. So, I mean, what did you think about that aspect of commodity money?
I try to relate it to what I see in the world today in terms of how do people adorn themselves aesthetically, especially with regard to their culture, in a manner to display wealth and status. And so I think about like, so I was recently in St. Louis, and I spent a lot of time in like the Ferguson area. And, you know, in that area, you see a lot of people that have like, they have like gold grills, right, in their teeth. And then they also have like on their vehicles, like they'll have like spinners and fancy wheels and stuff like that. And the converse of that is, like, here out in Western Kansas, you see a lot of people that they will have, like, really fancy leather boots. They will have a really fancy winch on their truck. They will have big tires on their truck. Like, so what it becomes is like the instance in the video game where the Stone of Jordan naturally arises because it's more useful in terms of getting what you want. So in terms of getting what you want, like out here, Western Kansas, it's, you know, I want to have a truck that gets through everything when it rains, when it snows. You know, I want to have the winch, I want to have the big tires. Like, that's more useful than a Honda Accord and $3 million in the bank. That's more useful to you. And it's a way of not only displaying that wealth, but also it's a natural emergent property of utility in the commodity.
Yeah.
And in like Ferguson, where you have, there's a lot of, you know, this is a really impoverished location. Not a lot of people have, but like everybody there had used Cash App, like for a bank account. And a lot of them used pawn shops in order to pawn something, get some quick cash. And like that's what a grill is, like your teeth, like it has the usefulness of being able to walk into a place, pull it out and get money on the spot for it, and then hopefully come back and reclaim it. Whereas if your money's in the bank, then you can't do that. You have to wait on them. I thought of another really, I think, interesting example of commodity money based on, so the first part where you talked about in Lebanon, the guy robbing the bank to get his own money. So what is a grain elevator or a co-op? It's a bank for grain. It's where farmers have been convinced, basically, or whatever. For those of you who don't know, most of the way that harvest works out in grain areas is that farmers harvest their grain and they take it to town and they put it into a cooperative, a grain elevator, which is merely a place to store the grain until the cooperative sells it. So it's like, oh, you're part of this, you can either sell it to them on the spot or you can store it there and pay storage for it. And there's a lot, I mean, not a couple, but a lot of examples of during the 80s and during basically this farming crisis that went all across, or the 70s too, went all across the United States due to just horrific government over-involvement, putting price floors and price ceilings and manipulating. But anyways, long story short, is this is like a bank where farmers are storing their money, right? Their grain is their money. And there were a lot of instances where they tried to get their grain out and they were told that they couldn't. And so you had guys that would go in the middle of the night with a torch and cut open. Yeah. Or like run a truck into it.
Yeah.
And get their, like literally rob the bank of grain to get their own grain back out because they weren't able to. So
that's really interesting. And like Alden mentions, like grain does have a history as a commodity money in, is it Syria? Wherever, like, I think wherever Hammurabi's code was historically in place, there was grain was a currency and also the silver shekel, as I recall. And there were specific encoded, like this many grain units for this many, like a unit, like amount of exchange or whatever. And maybe a similar phenomena to what you notes is all the notes, like historically, using grain as a commodity money back then had social impact on the agrarian folks who raised it as well, because you would have this like prolific abundance at the time of harvest. And so, but then the rest of the year, you would, you know, be going in debt in order to win the time of harvest. You would then pay off your debts. So you'd accrue debts throughout the year, pay them off at harvest time. This then made it so that if there was a failed harvest, you know, prior to insurance and all that, people became literal debt slaves. They had no way to repay these debts. And so like this led to the development of elaborate kind of administrative structures to deal with this, where kings, all the notes, would periodically do, as a word for it, like debt.
Isn't it called like, a debt jubilee?
I think that's exactly it. Yeah, I don't know if Alden uses that in this chapter.
She doesn't, but I think that's what it's called.
That's exactly right. And it's like, that's, again, we just have these, like, the money is so important. The commodity that you use as money is going to bring with it all of these emergent social consequences based on its properties, whether it is perfectly divisible or not, you know, and just the nature of like this, all of it arriving at once during harvest, and then society needing to make laws to help deal with the consequences of using this commodity as money. So yeah, it's incredibly, again, money is such a deeply implicated aspect of our social structure that looking at it from all these different angles as a systems engineer, looking at the whole structure and contemplating as such, there's a lot of value to that. I guess one thing I didn't want to say though, unless you had something to add to that, when you note that like visible forms, visible displays of wealth, and you note them kind of interculturally within the United States, the ways that people, the status symbols interculturally that are settled upon in different areas and used to signal wealth. In the past, like a person would wear all of the beads and the feathers. I think Alden kind of, I think, notes that you did this to signal, like if you're using a social credit system, you want to show people you're a valuable member of the society. Like, oh, this person's got a lot of beads. That means that they must have killed a bunch of animals, brought a lot of value to society in the past. They are signaling positive social benefit and abundance of that. I want to form a family unit with them, breed with them, associate with them. But nowadays, that type of showy wealth is actually often a form of debt or abuse of credit. And so it's like, it's opposite. It's like in the past, showy wealth may have signaled abundance, but the money system is so perverted now that showy wealth is what people do in lieu of abundance. They want to falsely, I'm not saying it like I'm not accusing anybody or whatever. I'm not saying it's bad. It's just like that's an emergent social consequence, again, of the way that we've structured our monetary system, is that people want to signal abundance in a way that is actually leading them to have less and less abundance, and one might say be more not providing positively to society, but going further and further in debt. So that's just an interesting social consequence of our own monetary system, I guess.
If fiat turns everything upside down, right?
There you go.
The what would have been a display of usefulness and honor, basically, and
right.
You know, all of these virtues, today you can display the exact same thing, but it can mean something entirely opposite. So, yeah, you talked about I had forgotten that she mentions debt slavery. So debt slavery, people, I think, should look up and try to kind of understand what it was, because I just thought that debt slavery was this term that was sort of like pejoratively used to describe the system that we live in. But no, like debt slavery is like a real thing. Like in the Code of Hammurabi, they like even explicitly say, like, if I owe Grant a debt and I can't pay it, I can send one of my like family members or something to be his literal slave for X amount of time. And it even specifies like after this amount of time, like in the example was like 3 years, on the fourth year, that person returns. But for that time frame, they are literally debt slaves. They are a slave to that person because of the debt that was incurred and was not paid back. And so I think it was really cool to learn about the genesis of that term. I really mm-hmm. enjoyed that. I love the point that you made up. You kind of maybe blew past it a little bit without thinking about how awesome it was to talk about this. That's accusatorial. I do believe that you were very genuine in what you were saying about this, but that the it really matters what you use for money. Like, it really has massive implications. And one of the things that I had written when I was reading this was this thought to myself of the idea that instead of working hard for more money, what you should really work hard for is to find a harder money, is to find a money that's harder to replicate, that has a higher stock to flow ratio. Because what we've seen again and again and again, from seashells and beads to tobacco to video game artifacts to the Japanese invasion money to rhinestones, all of these examples, what we have seen is that if you if you're late to recognizing, I mean, it's just an extended Cantillon effect, but if you're late to recognizing that technology has come in to extract the monetary premium of your money by creating more of it and flooding flooding the market with it, and therefore diluting everyone else's time and energy that they spent in order to acquire that money, if you're late to that game, it doesn't matter how hard you work. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how smart you are. It doesn't matter. Like, you are going to be so far behind, you know, to see your wealth decimated. And I got a credit to, so Lynn Alden is one of my favorite analysts. And the other, I would say, favorite is Darius Dale. And Darius introduced me to this idea. So his whole philosophy is, don't lose, like, it's very important not to lose money, because of the way that percentages work that most people just don't understand, which is that if your portfolio goes down 50%, you have to make 100% to get it back up to the same spot. If it goes down 75%, you have to make 300%. If it goes down 90%, you have to make like 9,000. I can't remember. But anyways, like, so suffice to say, like, if you're late to the game, and you're watching your wealth get decimated 12% a year if you're owning United States dollars, or, you know, 1,000% a day if you're in Turkey or something like that, then you mathematically, it is nearly impossible to come back from that. Obviously, there's people that can do it, but it's just, it makes it so important, these conversations that we're having, in order for, I mean, obviously we're having these conversations because we find the body of work interesting, but I think it's so important for anyone who is learning from this to be able to recognize that, to be able to recognize that falling behind is way more dangerous than getting ahead is beneficial. It makes it almost impossible, and truly for generations too, like for centuries. You know,
it's just a good point too that, like, I mean, math is like an esoteric, arcane way of thinking that, at least to me, does not come naturally. And so, I mean, maybe look at the evolutionary story we get, where we begin with social credit, where we have this rough ledger in our head of, here's how much I've done for the community, here's how much I can expect. That's not mathematics. And so, like, mathematics does, the power to do mathematics obviously arises from some logical or rational capacity we have, but that logical or rational capacity is not necessarily tied to that internal social ledger we have. So the math circuit and the ledger circuit internally maybe aren't necessarily intertwined. At least they're not for me. The things you mentioned about to just signal my own ignorance, like, those statistics always amazes me when I actually do the math and see how these things pan out. And so that's one way in which like, even the most simplistic seeming discussion about mathematics can help people be more financially wise or whatever, and understand the nature of money. But I guess this is maybe a related point that I wanted. I don't come away from this chapter, though, thinking that like, ancient tribes, early people are ignorant. Like, the people that were using shells were using it because that organically emerged as, like, the shelling point in this incredibly complex societal context, where you had, you know, different tribes, maybe even spoke different languages. And so, like, what they, the, like, arriving at money was, in one way, a way to obviate violence, because you don't then necessarily, you know, if you can't barter with someone, maybe you take that thing. And so, like, shell beads are a brilliant, like, Alden mentions this, that shell beads are perhaps in Africa the first savings technology humanity came up with, because they're a portable sort of value that can be traded away, portable and durable. Portable, you can move them through space. Durable, you can move value through time. And like, this is a book about technology. Shells are a technology. They are a monetary technology. In the history of man, we have fire, we have the wheel, we have shell beads as a brilliant emergent solution, a piece of technology that humanity innovated through necessity or whatever way. And so I look at this and I see the demise of all these other monetary systems, but it's not because the people were foolish. And so don't think that, oh, I'm not foolish. You know, nowadays I can see, have humility, I think, is one of the lessons of seeing how technology, new forms of it, sneak up on people who are too complacent, just naturally and not accusatorily or whatever, about the systems that they use.
Yeah, you bring up a good point in that. I mean, that. So really, if you want to compare, if you want to evaluate money based on its stock to flow, then those beads were a hell of a lot better money than fiat. Like, yeah. So those tribes thousands of years ago were using a far superior form of money to what we have. It's just true. Good. Like, it absolutely is. Yeah. There's a couple things I'm going to hit on here. So let's see how I can do getting them out. First off, great point about how trade obviates the need for violence. And this is something that we learned from Jason Lowry in his thesis, was the benefit to cost ratio. So you and I meet and, you know, it looks like I might be able to surprise you and ambush you, but you're a bigger guy, you're a stronger guy, my chances of being able to take you out and take the furs off your back, I'm going to guess that they're pretty low. But they're definite. I have a non-zero chance of winning, and I definitely have a non-zero chance of losing. But if we have something that we can pass between us, then I can then make that presumption of, like, well, I have a 50% chance of dying if I attack this guy to get his furs. I have 100% chance of living if I trade with this guy to get his furs. And all I have to give up is this, you know, these spears that I spent 3 days making. So, okay. So now what I'm doing is I'm making a decision where I value my life more than I do the 3 days that it took me to do that work. And it's really cool because it does decrease violence.
Yeah. And you could also say money could increase violence if it's bad, then, right? Money is a way if it's not.
Well, 1,000%. I listened to an episode of What is Money Today on the Breedlove Show. And he had this guy, Chris Sullivan was his name. And he was talking about how you can link every single war from the Battle of Waterloo, which was in the 1800s. Every single war after that has been what he calls a banker's war. Where, like, World War I began like a year to the day after the Federal Reserve was created. Kennedy, 2 months before he died or before he was killed, Kennedy had signed into effect an executive order, like 111105 or so. I don't know what it was, but an executive order effectively taking money creation powers away from the Fed and putting it in the Treasury, where they were issuing silver certificates. And 2 months later, he is assassinated, and then we go to war. Yeah. And it's just over and over and over and over and over. You know, so it's just, I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I don't think that you have to be wearing a tinfoil hat to look at it and say, well, the bankers are really rich, and they stay rich throughout the centuries. And one of the things that they benefit most from is war, because they get to finance and they make their money off of financing, which is credit, right? Which is expanding. You know, the way it works is the Fed creates $1 trillion and they sell it. They create $1 trillion worth of bonds and they go sell them to somebody. Or in today's case, they buy them back themselves because nobody wants to buy our bonds. And then they take that $1 trillion and they place it into the account of one of the 12 anointed reserve banks around the United States that then is able to create more money out of that, you know, $10 trillion, because you have lending limits that allow you to loan higher than the amount of reserves that you have. And so it just, and we saw examples of this with Lowry's thesis too, where Henry Ford's, you know, he buys a $30 million dam with the hope of creating an electric money because he realizes that gold causes wars because it requires somebody to centralize it, and then they can then loan against that centralization and live off of that continual debasement. I wanted to point out, I remember I had learned this stat a couple years ago and I just updated it today. So I want to bring this back again to talking about why I think Bitcoin is so important, which is that we do not have a clear pricing signal in the world today. And the way that we know that we don't have a clear pricing signal is we don't have a constant unit of account. Yes, the United States dollar is very popular across the world, but we have 160 odd currencies or whatever, and those are traded every single day in the Forex market. And you want to guess, so I'll give you, so the size of the United States debt is around like $35-36 trillion. How much do you guess is the daily volume of money traded for money, the Forex market? What would you guess at the $35 trillion of debt in the United States? How much would you guess is the daily volume traded?
I already said numbers don't even make sense to me.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, so
you'd be like 11.7?
11.7. Beyond 100, beyond the number of friends of my fingers of myself and my friends, then I can't go. There I do not go. So
at least it does. So it's 7.5. It's 7.5 trillion dollars a day.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
And by the way, so what's important about that number is that, to me, is that that means that let's just say that 3% of that, which it's probably closer to about 7, but let's just say that 3% of that is commission to the people that are making the trades. That's $210 billion a day of value that is literally just extracted and put into the pocket of the people that have the access to that.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that's an unbelievable, like, so, I mean, we're talking of like, we're complaining about how there is $1 trillion of debt being added every 100 days, right? And rightfully so. But there's $1 trillion worth of value being stolen through the manipulation of currencies every 5 days.
Yeah.
Like, so 20 times faster. It makes it so clear how Bitcoin can benefit. And the reason none of the, by the way, like, so the reason why all that trading is going on is because these countries are constantly changing interest rates with contracts or expands the supply of money. They're constantly printing more money, which increases the, you know, the amount, and therefore it's worth less. And so you're going to trade out of it. Like, so push that all to the side. And now you have a standard unit of account for the first time in history that people can actually use to properly send a signal to producers and consumers so that capital is allocated correctly. It blows my mind to think about the potential downstream implications of this. When people talk about how this can lead to abundance, how Bitcoin can fix these things, I don't think anybody's truly prepared for what a world looks like where we properly assign capital, where we don't have millions of acres of corn being grown in the Midwest where it's not meant to grow, where we don't have trillions of dollars being spent to make F-35s, or billions, I say, to make useless war equipment, where, you know, all of these things where it's just like we're sending the wrong signal to the market. Literally all we have to do is get out of the way. But in order to get out of the way, we had to create a money that we could use as a standardized unit of account. I think the unit of account thing is the most overlooked aspect of money because of how it affects the allocation of capital.
Yeah, and Alden does note right out the bat that that 160 more or less world currencies, like national currencies, because most of those currencies are only good within that jurisdiction, you essentially do have, as you mentioned with Forex, like this, a barter exchange amongst countries, and there is an inefficiency there. And just beginning chapter two, like, this is a perennial human problem. It's a problem now. It was a problem for early hunters and gatherers who needed a way to get past barter. And like, again, like Alden posed a question, is this really a wise thing for hunter gatherers to be focused on coming up with this abstract thing called money when they should be out hunting and gathering? And like, for sure it is, like, because of the efficiencies and all of the ways that it's going to enable, much more fluid cooperation and trading. And so perennial problem, problem then, problem now. Money just keeps on, hopefully through Bitcoin, getting better and better. I want to like say something that brings this back even to what I think is one of the most interesting things about chapters one and two is a society prior to money, and which is still our society in some ways. So there's just, this is something that Alden kind of mentions offhandedly, but it's a good point. And I think it has value to think about, especially even in our daily lives, that there is a value called relational value that she mentions. She gives the example of, this is kind of a dark example, but a mob boss who, somebody comes to the mob boss and they say, I need your help. This person has nothing the mob boss wants, but this person is part of the mob boss's social network. And so he extends them a favor. He knows that in the future, this person may have something I need. They're part of my social network. I can trust them. And so the mob bosses in this way are like, they increase their wealth because they invest in their social network. They give favors out and then they expect them in return. But I also just think that that's an important thing to consider in our daily lives. And we already do it, but like not in a cold, methodical way of I'm doing something quid pro quo, I expect something in return, but also to acknowledge like maybe you go out and mine fiat and get money to exchange for Bitcoin. That's good. But there is a lot of value also in the social network, doing things in the community for friends and kin and extending the circle of people who are friends. There is like literal value in that. It goes clear back to the being in a tribe and needing social insurance by when I'm going to be sick someday. And so I'm providing you with a lot of value now, because even though you have nothing to give me, when I'm sick, I want somebody to look after me. That relational wealth still exists nowadays. Maybe we see it even in the Bitcoin community. You see fellow Bitcoiners, you know that there can be more trust with somebody in the Bitcoin community than there is in a one-off exchange with a stranger. And so don't overlook relational wealth. Mine your fiat, increase your amount of Bitcoin, but also remember there's lots of forms of value in life, and that of the social network is very important.
Yeah, you bring up a really good point of the drawback of scarcity, which is that with fiat, you're just always like, well, cash is trash. I'll spend it because I can always get more. But there does sometimes sneak into the mind of someone who understands Bitcoin and realizes how valuable it is and how scarce it is. They make that their only thing in life, where I have to get more Bitcoin. I have to get more Bitcoin. Yep. I have to get more Bitcoin. It's like, no, what you need is an understanding of what enough is, of what is enough for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Because
the person, there's the famous story. I can't remember the exact people, but it's back in like the 30s, and there's an author, and he's at this like really rich guy's place, and somebody makes a comment to the author. They're like, hey, did you know this guy made like $1 million yesterday or whatever? And I heard that you're
Vonnegut.
Vonnegut. Yeah. And and his response is, he says, well, I have something that guy can never have, which is that I have enough.
Yeah.
So you do bring up a really good point about this kind of the psychological hell, really, that somebody can meander through if they do choose to, like, focus their entire world around Bitcoin. I had a really, I think this is a cool example of how the barter system, the social credit, the kind of, how the sort of like pre-money system is still at work today in small societies, which is like in base. I feel like this happens most in the NBA. In professional basketball, but you'll see like occasionally you'll see like a six team trade where it's like this guy's going to this team, they're sending two guys to this team who are sending a guy to this team, and it just and it, you know, there's only like 30 teams or whatever, so it requires, it's this small cohesive band of people, and all the general managers are talking, they're throwing out ideas, and it just so happens that you can actually make something like that happen, where even though the double coincidence of wants does not exist between the two initial parties that want to talk, that you're able to resolve that by using multiple parties within the trade. I thought that was a really cool thing to think about, was how we still have examples of that even in modern society.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We transmit values in different ways. In some situations, it would just be crass, perhaps, even to use money. And at the end of the day, we are apes, evolved apes, with the capacity to maintain a social ledger in our brains. And so it's a superpower. We use it in different ways.
Yeah. I was trying to think. Oh, I loved, by the way, so she defined, I'm just kind of drawing back from my notes right here, but defines monetary premium as a massive and permanent advertisement to try and make more of that thing.
Right.
And it really is. It's just this constant signal to the world, like get more, get more, get more. And I think maybe, yeah, maybe it's a good way to leave it here, which is to say more is not what you're seeking. Enough is what you're after.
Right on. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what else you got?
I feel like that's enough. Why add more? We've arrived at enoughness, a fullness existentially, personally, morally, ethically, financially.
We are enough.
We are enough.
You are enough, Grant.
Thank you. I feel great.
All right, we're both enough, and I think that's all we have then. So, again, thanks for everybody who's following along with us. We're reading the book Broken Money. This was chapters 1 and 2. Would love it if you want to read along. Obviously, the next thing that we'll do, if you haven't figured it out, is chapters 3 and 4, and so on and so forth. Read along, interact with us if you like. We try and monitor the channel so that we can answer questions and further the discussion here of what we find to be a very important topic for people to understand and to explore, and also just an intellectually stimulating way for us to converse. Grant is at The Whole Frame on Twitter, X. I am at Lucas Matty on X. These podcast episodes are posted first on X, then on YouTube, and then on Spotify. Please like, subscribe, hit the bell, whatever they ask you to do. It's really cool just to see people kind of gathering around this and wanting to support something like this, where we get to explore really cool ideas and have really good discussions. So anyways, on that was more than enough. And so we are out, and we will see you guys very soon.
Right on. Thanks, Lucas. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Grant.